is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll explore how to live well with celiac disease. Also, how MRI-guided lasers are a safer and better treatment for children with brain tumors and epilepsy. But first, what is the current state of organ donation here and throughout our country, and how can we help? Nationwide, there are over 100,000 people on waiting lists for organ donations, and for some, time can simply run out. So why is there such a long list, and what can be done about it? Joining me with more on this is Rob Kochik, Executive Director of the Finger Lakes Donor Recovery Network. Welcome.
Hi, Linda.
Thanks for having me.
So
first, tell us a bit about your organization. What is the Finger Lakes Donor Recovery Network?
Sure. We're one of 58 agencies throughout the United States that are known as an organ procurement organization. And we serve as the liaison between the patients that you just mentioned that are on the waiting list for an organ transplant or someone who needs a cornea transplant or a tissue transplant, and the patients in our local hospitals. We work with about 37 acute care hospitals in a 20-county region of upstate New York. And the patient's hospitals notify our agency at or near the time of a patient's death, and we evaluate those patients to see if they can be potential donors. And when we have either authorization or consent from the family, then we coordinate the organ recovery.
Wow, so you're really at the cutting edge, so to speak, or on the fighting line for organ procurement.
Exactly.
In our area, anyway. Exactly. So why is there such a shortage nationwide? What's contributing to the growth of the need for organs?
Well, the growth for the need for organs probably is multifaceted. One is, and I'm guessing we'll talk a little bit about it later, the success of organ transplants that have been in existence now for about almost 60 years. Baby boomers continue to age. And as we get older, we often have diabetes or hypertension or heart disease or different things. So there's more organ failure, so to speak, which results to more people on the waiting list.
So really, basically, the fact that there are that many more baby boomers in that aging population is driving up the need for more organs.
Is one factor. And just, again, the success of transplants. So not only do baby boomers receive organ transplants, but children and really anyone of any age can develop, you know, kidney disease or heart disease or liver disease.
Now, you just alluded to the fact that there's been a greater success over the last 60 years. So what organs are in greatest demand, and where is the greatest transplant success?
Sure. Well, I always answer that first question of what's the greatest need is the organ that I need. That I'm on the waiting list for.
Right. So each person is feeling...
Exactly. From a number standpoint, the majority of patients on the waiting list are waiting for kidney transplants, again, because of the history of hypertension and diabetes and liver failure,
and maybe the
kidney failure.
Increase in diabetes nationwide also maybe adding to that need for kidneys?
Absolutely. And then next would probably be the number of patients waiting for liver transplants, heart transplants, then lung transplants, pancreas transplants.
And which are of greatest success? Which have the best success track record?
Most folks are surprised to learn that if I received a kidney transplant today, my success rate for a functioning kidney and the ability to save my life is well over 90-95%.
Well, that's stunning.
Someone who's waiting for a heart transplant can be anywhere between 85-95%. And to think that, you know, here we are in 2013, that we can have such high success rates is just amazing.
It is staggering, because I remember when the first heart dating myself, when the first heart transplants were undertaken, and it was very iffy. first of all, even for the to make it through the procedure, but then on, you know, after a 5-year period, very few survived.
Exactly. So the first kidney transplant, you know, was done between two identical twins in 1954, and that was before we knew anything about tissue typing or matching and or even the use of immunosuppressant medications to manage that rejection. You know, you mentioned the first heart transplant back in 1967, and it really wasn't until the mid-80s when cyclosporin was the medication that really revolutionized organ donation and transplantation. Because
in what way?
Well, with cyclosporin, which was just such a wonderful, powerful anti-rejection medication, that it made it possible for us to transplant lungs and hearts and livers along with kidneys. Nowadays, most recipients aren't on cyclosporin anymore because there's even, you know, better medications.
Next generation.
Exactly. And yet that's really what our continued challenge is that, you know, if you donate a kidney to me or I donated a liver or heart to you, our bodies still would recognize that as a foreign organ and we would always be in a constant state of hopefully managed rejection. And so maybe in the future we'll figure out a way to grow organs or really make it so that we wouldn't have to worry about rejection anymore.
Yeah, I want to get to that actually a little later because I know there is some very exciting new research that's just taken place. Right now, what are the numbers of people that are waiting in upstate New York for
any given day, we have about 750 patients that are on the waiting list. The majority, again, are waiting for kidney transplants. At Strong Memorial Hospital in Rochester, there's over 300 patients. And here at Upstate, there's about 260 patients waiting for kidney transplants.
Wow.
There's about almost 100 patients waiting for liver transplants at Strong. On any given day, there's about 45 or 50 patients who are waiting for heart transplants. I'm proud to say that just earlier this week, we coordinated a heart donation, and that heart was successfully transplanted into a patient at Strong.
Wow, that must feel really, really like a tremendous success. So how would you say this shortage is affecting lives?
The shortage, unfortunately, means that in New York State, in any given year, approximately 600 patients die on the waiting list. There's other patients that are removed from the waiting list because they waited too long and they became too sick that even if an organ became available today, they wouldn't be able to accept it. And thankfully, some patients, their condition improves where the physicians might have thought they needed an organ and then find that they don't anymore and they were removed. But 600 patients die each year in New York State on the waiting list.
So if organ donation increased, then some of these deaths could be avoided.
Absolutely, which is really why we encourage everyone to consider making that very personal decision to give the gift of life.
Well, tell us about some ways that people can donate organs.
Well, first and foremost, we would just really encourage all of your listeners today to ask themselves, is this something that I would like to do? And, you know, we can talk a little bit about maybe some of the misunderstandings that there are, some fun facts perhaps that people don't know. Make the personal decision. And you know, our mission from Finger Lakes Donor Recovery Network, of course, is to have universal acceptance that organ donation is a wonderful thing to do. And we'd like everyone to donate. We know that we'll probably never quite get there. And we do as support that if someone says, you know, this is not something I want to do, to make that decision. Next is to have the conversation with your family, to let your family members know exactly what you want. And then if you would like to register to be a donor, there's a way to document your request to be a donor.
Yeah, I want to hold you for a minute. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Rob Kochick. He's the executive director of the Finger Lakes Donor Recovery Network. And we're talking about the growing need for organ donation and how one goes about it. Tell me those three ways we were talking about that you could actually get involved in donation? What are the three circumstances?
Sure. One way to document your wish to be a donor is when you complete your healthcare proxy form. There's an option there where you can document and sign. The second way, you can go to our website, www.donorrecovery.org, and click on the Register Now button. Or when you next visit the DMV office, which we all need to do at least every 8 years, we have an opportunity to authorize the enrollment to enroll in the New York State Donate Life Registry.
But there are different ways to donate. In other words, as a living donor, you could make a donation, or after your death, you could make a donation. Explain that.
Sure. So for living donation, which again, many of your listeners may already know about, is that, you know, we could donate one of our kidneys, since we have two. And we could give that to a family member or a friend or someone. We can also at times donate a portion of our liver or a portion of our lungs. And those are surgical procedures and transplants that are performed at the transplant centers, and they have the policies and procedures to do that. Finger Lakes Donor Recovery Network is not actively involved in living donation. The second way that someone can donate their organs is after a neurological brain injury or illness. Patient is in the intensive care unit. The doctors and nurses have, over a period of time, performed all of the procedures and treatments, and despite those efforts, the patient then meets the criteria for brain death. And brain death in New York State and in all 50 states is a legal determination of death, which means that we are not in a coma. We are not in a vegetative state. It means that we have lost all brain function, including our ability to breathe on our own. And so the doctors perform tests. They make the determination that the patient's brain is no longer functioning. They're declared legally dead. And that's the time of death that is on the patient's death certificate.
And then still, is it up to the family to make that the decision if it hasn't been put in a living will of some kind?
Yes. So we then, when the patient has been declared brain dead, then we, even before then, have checked the registry to see whether or not the patient has given their legal authorization for consent for donation. And that is equivalent to when we make a will. And when you think about it, you know, you hear rare times that someone is contesting a will. And that's why it's important to make those decisions, so that that is legal consent, and your family then is no longer burdened with making that decision for you.
I don't want to run out of time, but there's a third way after cardiac death. Can you explain that real quick?
Yes. And the third way is what we call organ donation after cardiac death, which is really the way organ donation started in the 50s and 60s, because that was before we even knew that there was brain death. In this particular case, the patient, again, has a non-recoverable illness or injury. The family makes a decision based on patient wishes or what they think their loved one's wishes would be to determine that they are going to withdraw support and allow a natural death. And if that occurs, and if the patient's heart stops and their respiration stop in a particular period of time, organ recovery can take place after that.
Now, I know there's a new law that's going to soon go into effect that's going to affect New Yorkers. It's called Loren's Law in October. Tell us about that really briefly, because I don't want to run out of time.
Sure. Loren's Law is based on a little girl who received a heart transplant a few years ago, and she wanted to do something to really increase donation. So at the DMV office, we will now have a required section to either check, yes, we would like to enroll in the registry, or if we're not quite ready to do that, skip this question. But it will be a required field at the DMV application, as opposed to right now it's optional.
So it's going to at least give people an opportunity to be aware that this is an option for them. They can skip it, but it's to raise awareness in
Absolutely.
Any case. Well, it's an amazingly important thing, obviously, with all these people on waiting lists and at risk of dying without it. So I hope we've raised some people's confidence consciousness. And I thank you so much for coming in and sharing all this very important information with you, with us. My guest has been Rob Kochick, Executive Director of the Finger Lakes Donor Recovery Network. Next, how can one live well with celiac disease? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Back to HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. Celiac disease appears to be on the rise in this country, affecting about one in every 130 people. Also, recent evidence has indicated a high prevalence of celiac disease in patients with type 1 diabetes. All in all, these figures point to the need for many to live their lives gluten-free. But exactly how do we do this continues to be a challenge. Joining us this morning with some answers is Beth Hilson, gluten-free chef, cookbook author, and founder of the Gluten-Free Pantry, a line of gluten-free products. She is also president of the American Celiac Disease Alliance and a food editor for Living Without magazine, the magazine for people with food allergies and food sensitivities. Welcome, Beth.
Thank you, Linda. I'm delighted to be here.
Yes, it's wonderful to have you. Quite an extensive resume here, and we'll get to that in a little while. First, tell us how you got into this line of work.
Well, I was diagnosed with celiac disease many years ago when there wasn't anything available. And so I became a pioneer. I had to discover for myself what I could and couldn't eat. I had some basic guidelines when I was diagnosed and no resources. So I went to culinary school and I picked up the recipes and realized if I substituted gluten-free ingredients for gluten-filled ingredients, I could make something that approximated all those delicious foods I missed. And by not missing those foods, I was then cheating on my diet.
And not feeling deprived. So let's, for the sake of our audience, let's just review celiac disease mm-hmm. and why you need to be gluten-free. It's an autoimmune disease, and it's often inherited. Is that
correct? That's right.
Tell
mm-hmm.
us more about it.
Well, it's an autoimmune disease that usually expresses itself in the small intestine. And it's an inflammation when you introduce gluten to your diet and wears down the cilia in the lining of the small intestine.
Those are the little fingers that
stick
up.
Those are the little finger-like projections. And those are the projections where all of our vitamins and nutrients are absorbed. So it's also called malabsorption syndrome, which, for obvious reasons. But people often present with a variety of different symptoms. And some of them can be gas and bloating and diarrhea and constipation, weight loss or weight gain. But you can also have no symptoms and still have the disease. And the feeling is that about 30% of people don't have major symptoms, and it's only when the secondary symptoms arise that people discover that they have the disease. And those might be things like infertility, bone density issues, osteoporosis, terrible headaches, it might be neuropathies, anemia.
So it's the gluten is the protein that is found in things like wheat. Where else is it found?
It's found in wheat, rye, barley, and also oats that could be contaminated. Mm-hmm. It's a chain of amino acids. It's a seven-chain amino acid because rice and corn also have gluten, but it's a different kind. So if you have this gene and this autoimmune disease, when you introduce gluten to your diet, then you have a reaction to it. And it causes an inflammation, which we're now realizing is not a good thing to be having in your body.
And all these other secondary possible
That's correct.
Disease
right.
entities that follow, other autoimmune problems as well.
Right.
So treatment is basically a gluten-free diet.
It
That's
is.
All we have
it is.
Right now.
Right.
Okay.
Imagine that eating a brownie could be your medicine. It's pretty neat.
If, in fact, it doesn't have gluten.
Right. Exactly.
Otherwise, it could be.
Yes, it could be.
Your
problem.
Poison. That's right.
Yes.
So are there people, is there a continuum in terms of people who have gluten insensitivity versus real celiac disease?
There, you know, one of the things they're discovering now is that there is a group of people in the world that seems to have a reaction to gluten that is not autoimmune, but has all the similar characteristics except the autoimmune component. So
Which
when
means
you
what?
Well, the autoimmune component actually can be detrimental to your health and actually can produce even lymphomas. So if you're celiac, you would have that autoimmune component. If you have gluten sensitivity, you might have the gas and the bloating and those kinds of symptoms when you eat gluten. But you would not have the autoimmune reaction.
And they can determine this through some kinds of blood assay testing?
It's harder to diagnose. I think there's a lot of research going on right now because the estimate is that between 18 and 20 million people might have gluten sensitivity. So it's a big, you know, it's getting a lot of attention. But there aren't too many things. I think usually it's treated right now by just removing gluten from the diet.
So getting back to that, excuse me, that seems to be the major thrust, obviously. The treatment seems to be, no matter what the underlying
That's right.
cause, is
That's
to
right.
get rid of gluten. How hard is that to do today?
It's not as difficult as it was when I was diagnosed. There are many, many more products available. And restaurants seem to have what I call is a high gluten-free IQ. Of course, you have to make sure that if you have celiac disease that you don't have cross-contamination issues when you're eating something in a restaurant, such as if the water is shared, you know, for pasta. Yeah, people might get sick from that. But in general, it's much higher than it was. It's much more, things are much more available.
Both restaurants and product lines.
That's right.
And you developed a product line. So
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
I understand is wonderful.
Well, it's very good. It's very versatile. And I started out making the products because there was nothing available. And this was back in the early 90s. Now there are tons of things available. But it's still, I mean, I use basic formulas from gluten-filled cookbooks, and I converted everything to gluten-free, which is the same thing I did in my cookbook, by the way.
Yeah, you have a new
makeovers,
cookbook.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So it's called Gluten-Free
so,
Makeovers,
yes.
And you offer 175 makeover recipes.
That's right, that's right.
Fabulous.
So it's the same. I think that's probably my mantra is just substitute, substitute, substitute.
Fantastic. So it sounds, from what I understand, that while most people with diabetes don't really have celiac disease, about 10% do.
That's correct.
So what about a gluten-free diet can help people with diabetes?
Well, first of all, it's type 1 diabetes. There's a correlation between type 1 diabetes and celiac disease. And you're right, it's about 10% of people with type 1 diabetes. The protocol these days is actually to test for celiac disease within a year of the diagnosis for type 1 diabetes. There are several aspects of the gluten-free diet that are beneficial for the general population, including people with diabetes. One is that you are much more aware of what you're putting in your mouth.
More mindful
and
about
mindful,
eating.
Right, right, exactly. And, you know, you're not eating all the processed foods that can be very harmful, hydrogenated fats and empty calories. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so the main thrust of the diet, besides substituting gluten products, is also more of like a Mediterranean diet, fresh fruits and vegetables. Is that
That's
part
right.
of what you
those,
advocate?
Those are all, I do, definitely. I mean, those are all very healthy choices, and they are, you know, inherently gluten-free. Olive oil is one of my friends, my best friends, mm-hmm. personally. But also, there are some wonderful nutritionally dense flours that are gluten-free. And I think we've all been missing that for so long. And we have more choices than people who are gluten-filled,
actually. So name some of these flours.
Amaranth, quinoa, sorghum, chickpea flour, and they're all high in protein as well as fiber. And these flours are great to as whole grains, but they're also great to cook with. And they can be used for baking. They can be used as part of your blend when you're cooking. They can be used to coat fish, chicken.
Someone pointed out to me, though, that with diabetics in particular, that some of these alternative flours maybe have a high glycemic index and therefore can create some difficulties in diabetics in terms of their ability to control their blood sugar.
Yes, exactly.
So and what do you recommend then?
Well, I would recommend the nutritionally dense flours we just talked about.
And they are not, they not have a high glycemic index.
No, they're actually very good. They have probably, I think all of those I mentioned, you know, roughly 3 to 4 grams of protein per serving and 3 to 4 grams of fiber. And that's the kind of thing that you want to look for. But they're also great to bake with, and they taste good.
And they regulate, you say, they actually do regulate.
They moderate. And one of the drawbacks, I think, of the gluten-free diet in the past has been that it uses so many empty carb. It provides an empty carb load. Lots of white rice flour, tapioca starch, corn starch, potato starch. And those are not as healthy. And you can feel, I mean, even if you're not diabetic, you feel that load and you feel that drop in your blood sugar maybe 20 minutes after you've eaten. So it's not as good a choice.
In the very little bit of time we have left, I have one other very quick question. Since celiac disease is an autoimmune disease, is there evidence that becoming gluten-free can help with other autoimmune diseases like RA, things like that?
There is an indication of that. It seems that, and more research is being done, but definitely people are reporting that they're feeling much better if they have a gluten-free diet, if they have RA or MS.
You wear so many different hats. I mean, you're a president of American Celiac Alliance, whatever. Where can people get more information about you and what you do?
Well, I have a website, glutenfreemakeoversplural.com. And then also you could go to gluten.net, which is a great source. The American Celiac Disease Alliance, which is americanceliac.org. And then also celiac.com.
Wonderful. We're going to link to all of those on our website.
Great.
Thank you, Beth, so much for joining
us
this
morning. It's a pleasure.
Thank
you.
My guest is Beth Hilson, gluten-free chef, cookbook author, and founder of Gluten Free Pantry, a line of gluten-free products. She's also president of the American Celiac Disease Alliance and a food editor for Living Without magazine, the magazine for people with food allergies and food sensitivities. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. There's been so much talk of late about red meat. Is it a dietary friend or foe? Well, in this week's Healthy Eats segment, Terry Podolak, Upstate Registered Dietitian, is here with some answers. Hey, Terry.
Hi, Linda.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
So to begin with, what is the nutritional value of meat?
Meat helps us with our tissue repair and replacement. It's really the architecture of our muscles and our bones. Meat also is an important source of iron, and it also helps build some of our enzymes and our hormones. It provides us with some of our B vitamins, particularly B12, which is good for our nerve cells and our red blood cells also.
I've often heard that meat also is a very important source of protein.
Yes, it's a main reason. Again, it's to help repair and heal. If we've had a wound, we need extra protein for tissue repair and replacement.
So what is nutritionally bad about meat? We've heard these alleged stories that eating red meat cause heart disease or cancer.
Yeah, I think what happens is people make meat the center of the plate where it really should be the side of the plate. It needs to be a quarter of the plate and fill your plate with vegetables. But as far as disease prevention, yes, they're looking at studies. They look at more maybe the processed meats, the cold cuts, and things that have more nitrates in them or higher in sodium. So you know, and meat traditionally we know is a little bit higher in fat, harder to digest. So again, I think if we look at just the portion of it, meat has definite health benefits, but we need to make sure we include those vegetables.
So when it comes to cancer, there have been some results that have shown, I guess, that there's a higher incidence of colorectal cancer, that kind of thing. But for the most part, I think what I've come across is that the jury is out. The studies are not conclusive in terms of that red meat does really raise the risk of either heart disease or cancer.
Exactly. And you know what they're really promoting now, too? Look at grass-fed meat, because that has an omega-3 higher content. So that will, again, that's another health benefit that will help you. But again, I think it's a portion and where our red meat is coming from. So, you know, further studies I'm sure will show. But I think right now when we're shopping, we need to look for grass-fed meat, protein source of eggs, see that they're, you know, are they free-range eggs? What are our eggs eating? What are meat? I often purchase bison from a local market. So the bison are ranging free and eating grass. It's a nice lower-fat red meat.
How much red meat should you eat?
About 4 ounces, really, is all we need. And the Mediterranean.
You mean at a sitting?
At a sitting.
But how about during a week? I mean, should you have meat at every meal?
No. Well, red meat, particularly the Mediterranean pyramid, only says monthly. So we want to include other, you know, meat sources.
What other sources of protein, though, would you recommend then you're not eating red meat?
Right. Fish is wonderful. And, you know, vegetarians now, we want to push our beans, our nuts. Even people are eating a lot more quinoa. That's a good protein vegetarian source.
How about some dairy like cottage cheese? Does that also give you adequate protein?
Yeah, cottage cheese would be another source. Eggs. I like to emphasize again the free-range eggs.
So basically, you can live very comfortably with meat if you do it in moderation.
Exactly.
But you can also do well without meat if you make sure you get the things that'll give you B12 and all of those kinds of.
Yes, you may need a B12 supplement if you're vegetarian. But whatever your food preferences are,
you can manage it.
Yes.
Well, that's great. Thanks, Terry. Lots of food for thought.
Thank you.
Next up, the MRI-guided laser and how it's helping kids with epilepsy and tumors. And don't forget to stick around for a visit from the Healing Muse. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for August 26th. Shake your salt habit. Did you know that you can train your taste buds to enjoy less salt? When you gradually cut back on sodium in your diet, your taste will adjust too. Plus, you'll experience all the subtle flavors you've been missing. Keeping your sodium intake under 2,300 milligrams a day, or less than 1 teaspoon, can also reduce your risk of high blood pressure, coronary heart disease, stroke, and kidney disease. It's easy to skip the salt shaker and opt for low, no, or reduced sodium soup, broths, and packaged foods. If your food seems less flavorful, spice it up with herbs or low-sodium seasonings. Start reducing your salt intake this week. Remember that it can take a few months to completely retrain your taste buds, so be persistent and take it one meal at a time. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. In the past, neurosurgical treatments for brain tumors and epilepsy in children required painstaking and challenging surgeries that often ran the risk of damaging healthy brain tissue in the process. Well, here to tell us about an exciting new minimally invasive treatment option is Dr. Sulma Tovar-Spinoza, the Director of Pediatric Neurosurgery at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Spinoza. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you've been involved in this new approach to treating brain tumors and epilepsy. Tell us about it.
Well, as I mentioned before, neurosurgery keeps progressing to try to do more with less. And we develop new techniques to try to address brain lesions without having the complexity of open surgeries. And I think that's where medicine is trying to go these days.
Not just in the brain, but all over.
All
right?
Over, yes.
So tell us, what is this? What are the types of tumors or epilepsy that you have been treating?
So certain patients have lesions on the brain that are very deep or are located in areas of the brain with getting access by open surgery is very complex and risky. So we try to find different pathways to get into these lesions without putting the patient on the risk of having any comorbidities or any deficits after the procedures.
So when you talk about comorbidities or deficits, you're really talking about unnecessarily damaging brain tissue
Just by getting into the lesion or treating these lesions.
So what exactly is involved? I mean, what are you doing?
Okay, so let's figure out that you have a head, and in the middle of the head you have a lesion, right?
The lesion is a tumor in this case.
Yeah, the lesion can be a tumor or can be any type of lesion that produces seizures. And remember, tumors can be good and bad tumors. We have a wide variety of these. But if you have a lesion or a tumor or any other type of lesions in the middle of the brain, and you need to approach them. With this new laser ablation technique, what you do is that you just make a little tiny opening in the skull that is actually 3 millimeters, and you introduce a laser that is 1 millimeter wide, get into the lesion, and then you take the patient to the MRI suite and you ablate, which means destroy the lesion under their vision on the MRI suite.
So in other words, the MRI are your eyes or help you. They guide you so that you can then position the laser exactly where you want it. Laser is just a light beam, am I correct? A high-frequency light beam.
It's a light-frequency light beam that is going to hit the lesion, and then when they hit it, they destroy the proteins, destroy the cells. But you can do this under a controlled environment, and that's what the MRI gives you, the direct vision to make a perfect planning where you are going to protect the brain that you want to protect, and you're going to destroy the lesion that you want to destroy.
So you said earlier they're good and bad tumors. Explain that.
Yeah, so not all the tumors are malignant, but there are benign tumors that are located in bad locations that can act as malignant tumors. For example, tumors on the brainstem. And remember, the brainstem is just this bridge that communicates the brain with the rest of our bodies. And many vital functions are located there. So if you have a tumor there, it's very difficult or very challenging to get through this to these tumors by surgery.
Without destroying a lot
without
of other
destroying
functions.
Another other functions of exposing the patients to several risks. Even that the tumor is benign just because of the location, we say, oh, this is a very high-risk tumor, very high-risk surgery.
So who generally are the patients that you see? I mean, who gets these kinds of tumors? Is it, we're talking adults as well as children, or largely children?
This technology was actually first checked on patients, adults with malignant tumors that were resistant to chemotherapy and radiotherapy and many other treatments. And then we started to treat these patients. And when I say we was the pioneers on this technology, under these patients that had no other options. And then we started to learn that this technology is helping them.
So it was superior even to doing the chemo or radiation. This was a superior treatment.
It's an adjuvant treatment. Series and the results are coming out at this point. I mean, again, this is an emerging technology, and we are happy to say that we are one of the pioneers in the world using this technology for pediatric patients.
So Golisano Children's Hospital right here in Upstate is one of the pioneers using it.
Yes, and we are one of the pioneers developing protocols for patients, pediatric patients with brain tumors and with epilepsy.
Wow. So help us understand, give us an example of you found this tumor through an MRI or something of that nature. You make this decision that you're going to ablate it or burn it out, so to speak, using the laser. And you then, I mean, are all patients equally good candidates for this kind of work, first of all?
And that's part of the learning curve of this technology, right? Initially, we'll say, as we mentioned before, that only patients that have failed other treatments were candidates for that. Now we are learning, and we have learned in Upstate that by doing patients, even as the first line of treatment, this is an optimal option.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here along with neurosurgeon Dr. Zulma Tovar-Spinoza, and we're talking about MRI-guided laser surgery. Well, it sounds almost like space age. I mean, it sounds such a miracle to be able to avoid, first of all, a whole craniotomy, removing half the skull to be able to get into the brain, and then all of the dangers of infection and potential of issues with healing afterwards.
And the length of a stay in the hospital, because patients will bring the patients to the procedure and they usually can go home the next day.
Wow.
And instead of having an open, having an open surgery and being in the hospital for 4 or 5 days and then going to rehab, certainly there is always a risk of doing any single procedure on the brain, but we have been learning that this minimally invasive option actually reduces all these risks.
How long does it usually take?
It depends on the difficulty of the lesion. Patients with brain tumors usually is a straightforward one laser, 6 hours procedure, because it combines the time in the OR and the time in the MRI. But hopefully with the new cancer center next year, we will have an intraoperative MRI where that will optimize our timing.
Which means the MRI will be
in the operating room. Mm-hmm. And that's the great thing about having our own cancer center. But in patients with epilepsy, for example, which is another population that we are addressing, that where we are really, really the pioneers in the world, we have sometimes to put 2 or 3 lasers depending on the areas of the brain that we need to ablate for patients that are having seizures.
So help me understand. Epilepsy is usually caused by some lesion in the brain that then it kind of sends off some kind of irregular electromagnetic...
It's a mismatch on the electric communication between the neurons in the brain, okay? We classically said that if you can point by all the pre-seizure evaluation where the place of the brain where the seizures are coming from, you can treat it surgically.
So if you can find the spot, you can eradicate it.
Yes. But before this, we were doing open surgeries. And certainly there is a classification on which patient is really the real candidate for this. But we were doing extremely complex surgeries. The patients will sometimes require 2 surgeries during 1 week and long stays in the intensive care plus the time of rehab. Now we are doing patients as complex as tuberous sclerosis patients. And this is where we are the only ones in the world doing this.
Help me understand that. Tuberous sclerosis?
Tuberous sclerosis is a genetic condition when the patients are born actually with many brain tumors.
Oh,
but
wow.
These tumors are benign. But these patients will develop intractable seizures.
As a result of having
all those. As a result of this. So the open surgery for this will include bringing the patient to the hospital, doing one procedure, putting actually electrodes on the brain of the patient, close the patient, have monitoring the brain waves for several days, try to figure out which one of these tumors were the more active because they rotate.
Wow, that's so complex.
Yeah. And then do surgery and then do it everything all over again. What we are doing now with the help, and this is something that Dr. Ekşioğlu, the director of pediatric neurology, and myself have developed, is a protocol where we actually evaluate the patient. We address minimally invasive with laser the tumors that are causing the seizures. We do an immediate post-ablation EEG to see how things are looking, and then we do all over again 2 months later until we find that the patient is under seizure control and or the seizures are disappearing.
So by doing multiple laser procedures, you can eradicate
and that's what we are learning. So you can we are the only ones in the world doing that, wow. And we have done 3 patients. And the most, and I mentioned that on that video in YouTube, where I showed the technique of how to do this procedure in the Upstate video YouTube page, is that the most nice results is actually see how the patients improve on behavior and neurocognitive issues.
So they can keep learning and growing where the seizures would have interrupted that. So that's amazing, amazing. So you are hoping eventually that this will be something that could maybe even be done on an outpatient or in day-long surgery kind of center?
I think as we learn more about these procedures and the roundtables that we have nationally, the handful of hospitals that we are doing this technology, we learn that the procedure is safe. And just because we are pediatrics, probably we are more overprotective with our patients. But certainly in the adult world, these patients are being treated as an outpatient and even under local anesthesia, not under general anesthesia.
Wow. Well, that is really remarkable. I mean, this really feels space age to me. We're really on the cutting edge.
It's very exciting. Again, this is a novel technology, and we are one of the centers developing this. But certainly we are starting to publish our results on medical journals. And we have been worldwide recognized as one of the pioneers and the experts on this area.
Well, I can't thank you enough for coming in and sharing all this incredible information with us. It's very hopeful, especially for these young children who've been suffering with intractable epilepsy, whose learning has been impaired and their ability to develop normally, now have some real hope. And so I'm thrilled. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Dr. Zilma Tovar Spinoza, Director of Pediatric Neurosurgery at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
This is Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse, with tonight's selections. We talk a lot about the human spirit, how it survives unimaginable tragedies. We also get at The Healing Muse many poems from people who do yoga. Yoga must be some kind of wonderful, transforming, poetic device. The first poem I'm going to read is by Charlene Langfer. It's called The Lotus of Endurance. Endurance may not be the right word for it, for what's within us when we're not quite us, when waiting for the old us we know so well to return a missing part of our lives. I read about 2 Buddhist monks who walk 800 miles over 2 years of travel, and every 3 steps they bow until they reach the city of 10,000 Buddhas. This seems like a big-time kind of endurance to me. Bowing, of course, is a Buddhist practice intended to achieve certain benefits, a golden complexion, to reestablish a love for the routines of life, to purify the being, to achieve enlightenment. I'm talking about forms of happiness here, the real deal. Variations of bows abound. You may, for example, while bowing, place your hand on your throat to gain 60 extra nuances. The idea that practicing endurance, one bow by one, another by another, will keep us enlightened, keep hard times endurable, is part of the monk's journey. So I practice endurance too. Imagine its lotus promises. Rise up over what ails me with a well-studied bow, the graceful one. Each of us has one, the one within, my own lotus of endurance. The next poem I'd like to read is by Linda Albert, and it's called Of Physicists and Elegies, and it talks about how we endure loss. Nothing is ever lost, so say the physicists. Matter transforms. Ice to water, water air, bulb peony, mountain cave, mother egg, boy dust. It doesn't help to know this. My go-with-everything black jacket, its silver snaps, celestial ash, or unreturned in some illicit closet. the patience I once had. The firmer flesh of arm and thigh transmuted badly, full to empty, hard to soft. My college roommate, dead since April, plays her fiddle where only angels get to hear. The dopamine commands that tell my husband's leg to move escape. His vocal cords cannot connect. The whispered dial tone of his voice, a maddening wrong number. I want them back the way they were. The way they were, I want them. I mourn for silver snaps, concertos, husband, friend, flesh firm, vociferous, ironic, moving, ironic flesh, vociferous, firm and moving.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we explore the new safeguards against workplace hazards and how new legislation is protecting our kids against unnecessary sports head injuries. If you want to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. And be sure to stop by and see Upstate at the New York State Fair, Thursday, August 22nd through Labor Day, September 2nd, inside the Science and Industry Building to the right of the main gate. You can also find a schedule of our daily activities on that What's Up at Upstate blog. And don't forget, if you missed any of today's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website, HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio, and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.